Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. We kick off this brand new week with yet another weird law from around the world. As I said, we are coming to the end of the weird law series. We're going to see what we do after that series. But for now, this week's, or today's rather, weird law comes to you courtesy of South Africa. And it's specific to cat ownership. I bring that up because my producer in studio owns a cat, and I know a couple of other people that have cats, but we're looking at the rules around cat ownership, and even though these ownership rules are specific to local municipalities and set by local municipalities through their bylaws, there is a general rule of thumb around different sized properties and the amount of cats you're allowed to have. In the case of apartments, typically two cats. In the case of residential property, typically four cats. In the case of agricultural property, up to six cats. But you can, of course, apply for special permission from your local municipality should you wish to exceed any of those numbers, because they are the ones that write those bylaws and they'll give you an update from that perspective. It's a weird law. Courtesy of South Africa, and we'll see if we have any more from South Africa. You're tuning into the SFM Market Update with Moneyweb, and on the show today we're going to be taking a look at the Takeover Regulation Panel's decision to enforce a very interesting condition around the Bollaworld takeover. We're going to take a look at that with the team at Deal Leaders International. We're also going to speak to the International Trade and Administration Commission, ITAC, around the latest decision by the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition to gazette export controls around the chrome space. Then we're going to have a conversation with the pension funds adjudicator around the complaints that they have seen, the report that they have submitted to Parliament, and what that report says about what they were investigating. And then we've got a conversation with Old Mutual Insure, taking a look at the trust economy and farming in the trust economy. And then we're going to wrap up the show with a digital drive conversation with our resident tech and EV specialist, Nafisa Akabor. We're going to be taking a look at the banned use of power banks on Emirates flights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick off the show with a sense of how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers. That's Makwe Masilela. Let's take a look at this, see what to make of it. Dr. Masilela, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. We are in record high territory for the gold price, but in truth, we've been in record high territory since we broke above the $2,000 an ounce level, and we are dangerously close to $4,000 a fine ounce. I wager by the end of this week, almost certainly we will hit there, but we could even hit there by the end of tonight.
Anything is possible, and you are so right, you know. And the minute we saw gold crossing 2,000, I think everything just worked towards its favor. I mean, remember the geopolitical tensions, whether it's Russia, Ukraine, you know, Israel, Hamas. And Jimmy, not forgetting that central bankers have been the real buyers of the yellow metal for quite some time, you know. And then as you could see that, as much as we know that usually people hold or used to hold to the dollar as the biggest or dominating reserve when it comes to that a particular economy's reserve, but gradually we've seen gold, not just because only of its increasing prices, but people starting to lose a bit of hope when it comes to dollar. So people continue to increase their holdings. And remember also before the tariffs that were announced in the US, that we saw a lot of gold moving from London to the US so that they're able to move that before the tariffs kick in. So as it stands now, everything seems to be working in gold's favor. But I like what you said, dangerously, because it's kind of worrisome, because this thing, it seems it has been going up in a straight line, and we know that usually things don't happen like that. And you market participants, you know yourselves very well, you're going to get a very silly or simple excuse, you know, to take some of the profits. But the fundamentals as they stand, yes, we can all believe that, yeah, gold is still there to stay.
Just an update on that gold price as I look at it now. We are only $30 away from $4,000 of fine ounce. We're $3,970 odd there. So continuing to march to the upside there. Marco, I want to take a look at the other side of things in the form of the likes of Bitcoin that have been touted as digital gold. That also reaching a new all-time high. And in the context of what's been happening in the United States, the US government shutdown continues to weigh on market sentiment. I think when we initially heard that the shutdown was in effect, we weren't too concerned that it would have a big movement or a big impact on markets, but it is seemingly playing out and impacting the market.
And we know that, you know, the previous ones, anyway, remember that the last shutdown happened during Donald Trump's first term, but ordinarily we know they don't have that much impact when it comes to the economies. But the question still remains that it depends how long it takes. And a divided U.S. Senate is due to vote, I think, for the fifth time on the stopgap bill that will reopen the government and fund it through November the 21st. But you are right. I mean, there have been growing fiscal concerns in some of the world's biggest economies and adding to the momentum of what we call the debasement trade, as investors flock to the perceived safety of the likes of Bitcoin, gold, and silver, while pulling away from major currencies, but Bitcoin as well. The minute we saw governments, regulators starting to accept it, the minute we started seeing institutional investors starting to look into it, that itself should have told us something, that the minute this thing gets to be more accepted by a lot of people, then definitely there will be some traction on it.
Marco, let's take a look at the Rand. 17 Rand 20 at this point against the US dollar. We are seeing that the Rand has been quite resilient and fighting quite a bit in this space. If I look at it now from a weekly perspective, there's nothing that says to me we can't go push towards 17 Rand. How are we feeling about the Rand at the moment?
I think it will continue to trade within that kind of a range, you know. I mean, the 720, the 780. But remember, traders are increasingly convinced that the U.S. will cut interest rates again in October. And as a result, we saw the dollar nursing losses because of that notion. And that helped the likes of the rent to continue to be steady. So as long as we continue to have those kind of expectations, then definitely that will work in favor of the rent itself. And but also locally, I think most of the news or negative news have already been baked into the rent. And as it stands now, I don't see any nasty surprises that we might see in the next coming month or so. That is when it comes to the local economy. So all the bad news that used to affect the rand negatively, they're already in the asset. So it's more of a dollar play more than anything. And not forgetting that also firmer commodity prices, they continue to help because the rand itself is a resource currency.
We might not have any negative news now, but we do still have a midterm budget policy statement to look at in November, and anything can happen there. Makwe, I want to take a look at the local front. You touched on the fact that there's a lot of expectations in markets at the moment, internationally and locally as well, I suppose. I want to get your thoughts around perhaps what some of those expectations look like for you when you look at the markets, when you look at the commodities and the resources sector that's done more than 150% in returns for this year alone. Where do we start to place our expectations going into kind of the rest of the year, going into next year, understanding that we still have another rates decision out of the US, we still have our own midterm budget policy statement, we still have a G20 to get through. This is all before the year ends.
I think let's remember that the recent global sentiments, you know, it has been more about AI that has been pushing investor sentiments. And the likes of South Africa and the London Stock Exchange, who don't have exposure to those kind of stocks, that is, that they make up part of our local process. And we know, as you said, we have been held by resources because we expect to see demand picking up, especially from the likes of China. We have learned our lesson when it comes to the budget, that remember, it could not be passed through. I don't think the policymakers will afford to make that kind of a silly statement that will get other parties not to be happy. And I think they've learned how to work things out. But most of the things we know about, that we know that we've seen improvement when it comes to our electricity, we still have to see the issue about logistics, that they say they keep on working on them. So it's a question of trading carefully, and any surprises might not be nasty surprises, but economic wise, I think we have to give ourselves a clap a hands to ourselves that gradually, you know, we're getting things sorted out. It might not be at that accelerated speed that we're anticipating when the GNU was formed, but I think we are more or less on the right track as it stands. I think maybe things that might be surprise us are maybe the whatever that gets to come out when it comes to the likes of the Madlanga Commission that made my that might make investors to start losing hope when it comes to the economy itself. I mean, our manufacturing not doing that bad, you know, everything is not where we want it to be. But Jimmy, I think we're not doing that.
We certainly aren't doing that badly, and we could still have some good news before the month ends and before we get to that midterm budget policy statement, because we do have the ratings, or the review rather, coming through from the team at the Financial Action Task Force. A FATF review of our grey listing takes place this month. We are anticipating, hopefully, that we will be removed from the grey list. It seems we've met all the requirements around that, and as we get closer to that, perhaps we'll look into that as well and see whether or not we're optimistic about that. But for now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers, Marco Masalela, for joining us to take a look at market movements, market sentiment, and perhaps where markets are headed.
That's the sound of your business growing. Whether you're starting out or scaling up, turn your passion into profit with Capitec Business Banking. Save up to 50% on fees. Get fast credit approvals, personalized support, and Forex for your business. Open your business banking account on our app. Bank on better with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP. 46669. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
1 rand 20. That is the amount that has thrown a massive spanner in the works in the takeover bid for Barloworld. We know, of course, that this deal has been in the works for quite some time. We know that the acquiring company initially had put in consideration an offer of around 120 rand per share, and it seems that 1 rand 20 per share has thrown a spanner in the works. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Executive of Corporate and Deal Advisory at Deal Leaders International, Andrew Ballman, to take a look at this and see what you make of it. Andrew, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks for taking the time. Give us some context around how 1 Rand 20 a share has made such a big difference here.
Yeah, it's, you know, I suppose in isolation, it doesn't seem like a big deal, but essentially, the original offer that was put forward at the 120 Rand was then further diluted by a dividend that was paid out or to shareholders, which was the 1 Rand 20 per share. So essentially, the acquirers were saying, well, the valuation was at the 120, you received your dividend, so we're going to, our price is going to be net of that. And obviously, the spanner in the works now has come back from the commission to say, no, the purchase price is at the 120, which I think worked out about another 225 million odd rand, which has now, you know, challenged the overall price. So where it goes from here, I'm not sure. You know, the quantum of the deal, I would think it shouldn't scuttle the deal, but there's still, it's a big number, you know, and it's probably more of a principal issue as well. So I think what's added pressure to it is obviously it's come very late in the game. You know, so what should have been a formality has now come back to say, well, no, the share price actually needs to be that, you know, higher by that premium. So, yeah, challenging and never great from a deal-making perspective for something to come in at the 11th hour. But I guess now they're going to have to deal with it.
Andrew, let's look at the principal side of it, because as you rightly mentioned, 225 million rand, which is the swing that we're dealing with here, could potentially be absolutely nothing for the NewCo group that's looking to acquire Barloworld, or it could be a deal-breaking amount that they say it's not about the amount, it's about the fact that we had an agreement, we had principal, in fact. How do we navigate these conversations? Because some of it is an implicit assumption that this valuation includes this and this, it doesn't include certain things. But one could also argue that, well, it wasn't explicitly stated in writing when the offer was made, and it could have been explicitly stated in writing to say it would be net of dividends, but it wasn't.
I think that's the challenge. I mean, I think it's, in a perfect world, when you go into these types of situations, you want to have a memorandum of understanding or whatever you want to call it that really breaks down all of the details. So there is no gray. There's nothing left to interpretation. And obviously, at this stage, when now you've got to almost get back to the drawing board, the nature of the relationship between the various shareholders and the acquirers, if it's constructive and friendly, there could be something there and it could be negotiated. But at the end of the day, it's the shareholders will see it as two separate things, unless it was, explicitly defined that it was going to exclude or be reduced by the dividend that was going to be paid. From a shareholder perspective, it's two different things. I've got a dividend for the period I've held the shares and I want my 120. So it is very difficult to navigate because also there's more than one shareholder. So, it almost gets as complex as, getting to the original price because now there's that nuance and it adds complication, it adds pressure, it adds more time. And the longer things take, the more risky they become. So yeah, it opens up a new can of complication, and challenge and risk, I guess, that's going to now need to be dealt to. But the rule of thumb always is try and get it all in writing because it's not like this is a left field thing. It was, dividend's a dividend, but again, the parties obviously just spoke past each other. And now there's a challenging situation that there's a divide that needs to be bridged.
Andrew, one might argue that this could have been left out intentionally to then create this problem. I mean, not on the part, well, not to say that it has been done so on the part of NewCo, but we've seen in the past where one party in a deal will conveniently forget to mention something and knowing full well that the ex-dividend dates happen at a certain time, the transaction will likely run over into that time, especially from a due diligence point of view. I mean, you see these deals, you facilitate these deals, and these are the things you would, I would imagine, take a look at as well and say, let's put a timeline together. This is what's going to happen. This is what will overlap. How much of this then actually puts the deal at risk, and how much of it is perhaps just natural oversight?
Yeah, look, there's always that gray. So whether it was intentional or not, one would never know. But it always takes two parties to conclude a deal. And, it's one of those situations where if it's not mentioned or dealt with, then we default to assumption, which is always dangerous. And, I would put the onus on both parties for clarity. So if one party hadn't disclosed or hadn't broken it down at a granular level, the existing shareholders should have got further clarity, because it is one of those things where I hope it was just an oversight. If there was anything else there, then it's probably a good thing it's landed where it's landed, because you've also got to come down to alignment and integrity between parties. But it is what it is as well, and it's just again it adds complication and risk to the situation. But they've come a long way, and they've got so many approvals and all of those things. So for this thing to fall over at this stage, it'll be interesting to see how the selling shareholders dig in and how flexible the new co is going to be, because there's a lot of time and effort and capital invested already, and there's reputation. So yeah, there's layers to this, and I suppose the next couple of weeks will be very interesting to see how it plays out.
And there's also the matter of 225 million rand in additional monies that must be paid. Andrew, do you think this was
Possible
the
change.
right, do you think this was the right call by the Takeover Regulation Panel?
It's always tough. I think they've got to be purist, so they've got to be based on the facts. So in the absence of anything, giving clarity that it was, including or excluding, they've got to, adhere to what and honor what the original arrangement is. It's late in the game to be doing it. I don't think this is, anything necessarily like that just happened last week. But yeah, I think typically they would take the high ground and they would go with what's in writing and what's enforceable. So I'm assuming that's what they've made their call on.
As Andrew said, we'll have to see how this unfolds and how this shapes up. One hopes that this doesn't deter the deal. Perhaps both parties might just split the difference down the middle and share the costs, but we'll have to keep an eye on that and see how it goes. Andrew, thank you so much for those insights and for the time. Always lovely having you on the show. Andrew Bauman, Chief Executive for Corporate and Advisory at Deal Leaders International, joining us to take a look at the latest spanner in the works that's been thrown into the Barlow takeover deal and how we deal with the additional 225 million rand.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The Minister in the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, Minister Park Stau, has begun the process of placing chrome ore under export control. This means that we are going to look to regulate exports of chrome and potentially look to impose some tariffs or some other regulatory measures on the export of chrome. For more details around this, I'm joined on the line by the Chief Commissioner at the International Trade and Administration Commission of South Africa, that is ITAC, Commissioner Ayabonga Kawe. Commissioner, always lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Can you perhaps give us a bit of background around the context upon which we arrived at this point for those that have missed the conversation?
No, thank you very much, Jimmy, and as always, to your listeners, for the opportunity for us to chat to you. And indeed, I mean, I think many of the listeners would be aware that South Africa is one of the largest producers, if not the largest single producer of chrome in the world. And we certainly in 2024 exported over around 20 million tons or so of this material, which is used for the fabrication of ferroalloys that are used in stainless steel and other applications. We've historically been a country that has had the main producers of ferroalloy metal material being those that are from this country. And over the last while, we've seen nearly half of those smelters closed, some being placed under care and maintenance, arising from the very high electricity costs relative to other countries that fabricate this. Let me give you an example. In China, you're paying around 60 cents a kilowatt hour compared to South Africa, where per kilowatt hour, some of the smelters are paying over 2 rand. And so there's the energy pricing competitiveness challenge that is confronting us. But furthermore, and I think this is where we come to the party, there has been a cabinet decision as of June this year to also place chrome exports under export control, which would mean they would require a license from ITAC. And that's the gazette that the minister would have issued on Friday. But there is also an element in that cabinet proposal around an export tax, which is something in the domain of the Ministry of Finance. And I would imagine that when the time is opportune, they will also avail themselves to talk about that.
Commissioner, given that South Africa holds more than 70% of the world's chrome reserves, clearly this is a strategic metal for us, as you rightly mentioned, in the global economy. From a decision-making standpoint, and at least from a tax point of view and a restriction point of view where it relates to exports, how much of the decision is being driven by some of the other factors that are happening around the world? We're seeing that growingly countries are looking to protect the competitive advantages that they have in various areas. I think of Taiwan, for example, and their chip production and their willingness or their lack of willingness to give up that competitive advantage. We're seeing the same thing from the US in terms of some tariffs that they're imposing. We're seeing it happen in China as well. From a South African point of view, how much of this is being driven by global developments and how much of it is this has always been on the cards?
Well, indeed, I mean, this is a historic tool we've always had as a country, actually. You might be aware that certainly since after the Second World War, South Africa would have had access to export and import controls. And as a result of that, would have used it for all manner of products. We still have kind of a wide array of products under import and export control. And so, yes, indeed, the new context to some degree might explain this. But on chrome, it's a historical debate. Even around the moment of the global financial crisis, certainly in my memory, you would have had calls from labor and even other parts of the society calling for taxation or export restrictions on the export of chrome as part of the debate on beneficiation in South Africa. So it's not a new discussion for us, nor is it a discussion prompted by the uncertainty in the global environment. I think it so happens, coincidentally, that the use of the tool of export control is becoming widespread, as we see in the United States, as we see in Taiwan, as we see in the People's Republic of China. And certainly we have had that instrument, as I say, for over 5 decades and have continued to use it to varying degrees. You would know, of course, all of our wastes and scraps of what are called critical minerals are already under export control in South Africa already. And so this is part of, I guess, our unfolding industrial strategy, which, of course, is considering chrome in this instance, alongside the other considerations on the energy side of things, which Cabinet would have given some attention to in June.
Commissioner, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the intended result of the taxes that will be imposed and on the stricter regulation of chrome exports. From a licensing point of view, I suppose that is quite self-explanatory. We do not want unauthorized individuals being the ones to move the chrome out of South Africa, and therefore that makes sense. The intended impact of something like a tax on the South African market, as well as on the chrome that then hits the global market, what is the hopeful outcome here?
Well, I think the intention is to make the terms of access to the feedstock material more favorable than our global counterparts for domestic fabricators and domestic smelters. If you add a tax alongside the licensing regime, the outcome that is intended is for the exported material to have a relative price premium compared to the product that would be available to domestic smelters. And arising from that, if you resolve the energy pricing challenges, it is a competitiveness enhancing play on the part of the policymakers who are using these trade instruments to at least change the terms of access to feedstock and, of course, the competitive environment within which our smelters operate.
Commissioner, have we put together numbers around how much this could add for revenues from a tax-based perspective? Obviously, understanding you made a very important point to say that the tax will be determined by National Treasury, and therefore that amount could be 25%, it could be 40%. Have we kind of done some numbers around what seems to be a reasonable tax percentage and how much it'll add to the fiscus?
It would be remiss of me to wade into that terrain. As I said, that is the terrain of the South African Revenue Service and the Ministry of Finance in particular. And I think they will be in a position to communicate when the taxation amendment laws process that would incorporate this particular export tax comes into play. So unfortunately, we can't really speak on that at this point. And it would be something we would certainly hope the Ministry of Finance will take the opportunity to speak to.
And I'm sure they will do so. And when they do so, hopefully we do have a figure that is competitive and doesn't take us out of the market, because as you rightly mentioned, Commissioner, the idea is to continue to remain competitive in the global space, but to do that in the best manner for South Africa. I think we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the Chief Commissioner of the International Trade and Administration Commission of South Africa, that is Commissioner Ayabonga Qawe, for joining us to take a look at the decision to move ahead with a tax and regulatory changes to the chrome exports that we have as a country.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM. This interview is brought to you by Old Mutual Insure. Protect what built you.
Several weeks ago, we started a conversation with the team at Old Mutual Insure around this concept of the trust economy. At the time, we were looking at the small businesses in the SME space in South Africa and how that related how the trust economy affected small businesses. We're going to continue that conversation. We're going to be taking a look at the farming landscape. We have an array of farmers in South Africa across many different types of products and, I suppose, sectors as well. And we're going to take a look at what the trust economy means for them. I'm joined on the line by the executive for on-platform business solutions at Old Mutual Insure, Nicholas Dempsey, to see what we make of it. Nick, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. What does the trust economy mean to a farmer?
Well, firstly, Jimmy, I just want to say thank you to you and your listeners for allowing me on your show tonight. Yeah, I think it's a great question, right? And for me, sort of, you know, agricultural sector is more than just farming, right? It's a vital part within the economy of South Africa. And I mean, let's be honest, Jimmy, it also feeds the nation. So for me, I mean, why is the trust economy so important? I think sort of trust is built over many years in the farming community and over many generations. And it goes just wider than the farm itself. I mean, it spans across families. It spans across the employees that work on those farms. It also spans to the neighbors that are adjacent to those farms and even the communities in which those farms operate. So for me, I mean, it's a vital cog in South Africa, and trust for me is earned over many, many years. And it's sort of risks that you just don't want to undermine over time. So yeah, it's for me, it's a vital sort of environment.
I think Trust in any business context is exceptionally important, especially if you're in a business that deals with customers and you need to build those relationships. But the relationships go beyond just that. And there's a lot of things that can put those relationships at risk. Nick, I want to take a look at that. What are some of the risks that particularly perhaps the agricultural space or particularly farmers might face that could undermine that trust?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? And it can absolutely do that over time. So, I mean, a couple of sort of examples that spring to mind for me would be things like sort of late frost. Theft of a vital piece of equipment is another thing, right? And storms and floods and all of these things can play a part in undermining trust of a farmer. Another sort of example, and specifically this time of the year, could be things like the spread of fire. And that could eventually become a runaway fire. And the damage that it causes, not just to the property of the farmer in question, but it could even go as far as adjacent neighbors too, and an element that goes into their bit of property as well. So these types of risks and these types of risk events can invariably affect the operations of a farm and can jeopardize the farmer's reputation over time. So it's definitely things that farmers should consider, you know, with valuable input of anybody in that industry, within the financial industry, and sort of keep their trust intact over many years in that sense. So, yeah.
Nick, let's talk protection from a farmer perspective. There's a lot that farmers put in place as much as they can. Some of these risk factors you've just outlined are beyond a farmer's control. Some are natural events that they have no control over. How do farmers start to then better protect themselves? What can they kind of put in place? And more importantly, when should farmers be looking to put these practical sort of security measures in place?
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question, right? Sort of, I mean, there's elements of climate change that are on the go that sort of farmers need to be aware of, and sort of the changing sort of weather patterns that are on the go. And we can distinctly see within sort of the insurance sector how the severity and of sort of these events are sort of portraying and sort of happening over the last couple of years. Furthermore, though, I think what's important, though, for the farmers out there is to partner with brokers. You know, the brokers in that instance understand sort of policies and the wordings thereof and how they can sort of best ensure that they are, you know, their risks are intact and they've got the right sort of advice at play. And in most aspects, I mean, for me, brokers are important for the longevity, you know, of the advice that they give farmers and the sustainability to make sure that the farmers' trust is still intact over the years to come.
Nick, can you give me an example of a situation where having the right broker in place has helped a farmer or helped the agricultural space or helped just maintain trust in a relationship? Because we hear of these broker responsibilities and these broker roles, and you've just alluded to just the importance of a broker. But can you just give us some practical insights around just how powerful it can be to have a broker in place?
Before I go there, I mean, I just want to just sort of reiterate the importance of brokers. And if you think about Old Mutual Insure, we've been around for 180 years, and our legacy has been built with our valued partners of brokers and customers. And I think for a broker, for me, is a customer may not necessarily know. When I say customer, farmer in this instance, may not necessarily know who their insurer is, but they do very well know who their brokers are. In most instances, sort of brokers will sit around a farmer's kitchen table and discuss the policy wordings and discuss what's been insured. Things, practical examples, I would say, is sort of, if you think about it, I've just mentioned around the spread of fire that's sort of potentially on the go now in the next couple of weeks and months. But in sort of the harvesting season's fast approaching, right? And when I say fast approaching, it's towards the end of the year. And brokers are paramount to ensure that sort of those assets that are in place with those specific farmers are insured at the right levels. Because for a farmer out there who wants to make sure they harvest the land, if that harvester has a catastrophe or a risk event that transpires, and the broker's given the correct advice, the sustainability of that farm, the sustainability of the farmer itself, and the employees that are on that farm and the community that they serve will continue to manifest itself over the years to come. So the broker for me is a vital and a pivotal role to help those farmers maintain their trust and maintain sort of the yield that they generate before their families, their neighbors, as well as the communities that they serve.
The importance of trust cannot be understated, and it is the cornerstone of not only the trust economy, but of business as a whole. And that's why it's important to have these conversations with your broker, with your service providers, and ensure that you're best set up for your business's success. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Nicholas for those insights and for the time. Nicholas Dempsey, the executive for On Platform Business Solutions at Old Mutual Insure, joining us to take a look at the trust economy in the context of the agricultural space.
This interview is brought to you by Old Mutual Insure. Protect what built you.
You know you're a farmer when your Sunday best still has bits of wire in the pocket, and a quick coffee means drinking it cold with a calf in one hand. When you fix the water pump with a bread bag, and your dog rides shotgun more than your spouse. Through late payments and broken promises, you keep farming because you're a farmer. As much as you've grown your land and your farm, it's grown something in you too. Chat to your broker about Old Mutual Insure Agri Insurance. Protect what built you. Old Mutual Insure Limited is a licensed FSP and non-life insurer.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, the pension funds adjudicator tabled their 2025 annual report in Parliament, taking a look at some of the claims they had to investigate. And amongst other things, amongst the more than 10,000 claims that they were, or complaints rather, that they investigated, almost 44% of those complaints were centered around employers failing to pay over retirement contributions. We're going to take a look at this and other insights from the annual report with the Deputy Pension Funds Adjudicator, Naeem Esopi. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of the information and where we go from here. Naeem, thanks so much for taking the time. Lovely to have you on the show. Let's perhaps start with an overview of the annual report and of the work that the Pension Funds Adjudicator does.
Thank you. So the Office of the Pension Funds Adjudicator is there to resolve disputes between members of pension funds and their pension funds. We operate as an ombudsman, and we investigate complaints and make orders that are binding on the parties and that can be enforced in the same manner that that a court order can be enforced. And in the last financial year, we received about 10,300 complaints, and we disposed of about 10,100 complaints. There's been a significant increase in the number of complaints that we've received, and that's because of the two-pot system, or what we believe to be because of the two-pot system that has come into effect, which has given people the incentive to go and look at what is in their pots and what they can withdraw from their retirement fund. And from there, complaints are organically being generated from that.
Naeem, let's stick with the two-pot side of it. We'll come to some of the other insights in a bit more detail. What have a lot of the complaints been about relating to the two-pot? I mean, to see more than 10,000 complaints, I can imagine your office has been busy throughout the year, and no adjudicator would like to see that number of complaints. What are some of the issues around the two-pot system here?
Well, I think the main issue is the non-payment of contributions by employers. So members of pension funds are not aware that their employers are not paying over contributions, because on their pay slips and salary advices, a deduction is shown, but when they go to the pension fund to withdraw from their savings pot, then they realize actually contributions haven't been paid for a while, and then they lodge complaints against their employers with us, and we have to investigate and find out what has happened.
Now, those contributions, that was something that I cited at the start of our conversation, to say they made up more than 40% of all of the complaints that were investigated. Surely that number is entirely too high and poses, I would imagine, some serious concerns for you as an adjudicator around what needs to be done here.
Yeah, well, it's more than 40% directly to do with Section 13A compliance, which relates to the payment of contributions. And in addition to that, is the number of complaints we receive in respect of withdrawal benefits. So you've got to combine those numbers, because most of the time the complaints relating to withdrawal benefits is also relating to the non-payment of contributions. So you're looking at about approximately 80% of the complaints that we receive relating to employees not paying contributions to the pension funds. And yes, it's an extremely concerning issue. We've been beating the drum about this for many years now, but it's only become to the fore now because of the two-pot system and people now being aware that those contributions are not being paid over by employers.
Naeem, I remember a conversation that took place with, if I'm not mistaken, the pension funds adjudicator with the SABC about 3 years ago, where, as you rightly alluded to, as the pension funds adjudicator's office, you have been on an awareness campaign around what employers need to do from a responsibility perspective, as well as what rights employees have. How is it that three odd years later, the message still isn't landing to some of these employers? Because surely this is a serious contravention of legislation, number one, but two, it means then that employees that work hard are put at a severe disadvantage.
That's correct. And it exposes them to risk, because normally these pension funds carry risk benefits, such as a death benefit or a disability benefit, and if employer hasn't been paying over those contributions, then those benefits lapse. So it's an extremely concerning situation. We've seen the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the FSCA, has started to publish lists of defaulting employers, and that's a good start. But we also want to see action being taken against trustees of pension funds that are not complying with their duties in terms of the FSCA conduct standard, and that is for them to monitor when contributions are coming in, and if those contributions are not paid, then they are obliged to take action against those defaulting employers. In addition to that, the Pension Funds Act makes it a criminal offense for employers not to pay contributions, and it says that if you fail to comply with Section 13A, then you can be liable for a fine up to 10 million rand or imprisonment for up to 10 years or to both such a fine and imprisonment. But unfortunately, it seems that complaints, when they are lodged by pension funds to the SAPS, it's not being effective so far. We've heard from the FSCA in recent times that there has been some sort of system being put in place, and that if pension funds are still experiencing problems with lodging criminal complaints, then they must report it to the FSCA.
Speaking of the FSCA, Naeem, I want to get your thoughts before we run out of time around the COFI bill. For those that don't know, that is the Conduct of Financial Institutions Bill, a new form of legislation that is being drafted and put together that aims to better regulate financial institutions that operate and offer financial services. This will no doubt have an impact on the Office of the Pension Funds Adjudicator, but on the pension funds space as a whole. I want to get your thoughts perhaps around how this could be an opportunity to right some of the wrongs and kind of clean up some of the grey areas that may have been around in the past, and just better protect pension contributors as well as employers going forward.
Yeah, so there's the some of the amendments that they are looking at to bring in with the COFI bill is to give the FSCA powers over employers, so that if employers do not pay over contributions, then the FSCA has jurisdiction to take action against them. So there is some positive things coming in with COFI, and COFI is going to obviously embed some of the TCF principles into legislation, so that when we are actually dealing with complaints, then we have something to rely on in terms of legislation.
Naeem, you mentioned that the TCF principles, the treat customers fairly principles, are what we need to be striving towards. Something else that we've touched on in this conversation is striving towards having no complaints, so that as the pension funds adjudicator, you at least know that things are on the right track. Now, obviously, we're a long way away from that, with more than 10,000 complaints in the last year alone. How does this then inform what your office then does going into the new year in terms of recommendations that you put forward, the recommendations you put forward to Parliament and perhaps even to the contributors of these pension funds, so that we can have a better run system?
Yeah, I think it starts with the pension funds themselves. We want to see customers taking their fiduciary duties quite seriously and enforcing those provisions in the legislation that require them to take action against defaulting employers. So that is actually the starting point. And once that starts to happen, then I think all other things will start to fall in place. So that would be my main recommendation. Yeah.
In terms of those fiduciary duties, Naeem, that is something that's, again, is part of legislation and part of law and should be put in effect from the beginning. Is the Office of the Pension Funds Adjudicator empowered to take certain actions in the absence of, say, governance and law and all of that? You touched on the fact that there are certain provisions that empower your office to then be able to put in place certain recommendations. Does this extend to governance, or is that more something that we need to look at under the Companies Act and all sorts of other legislation?
Yeah, well, so the pension fund, Act is regulated by the FSCA, so it's the FSCA that would look at the governance issues, etc. Our office would deal with complaints, and we can only deal with complaints that are lodged with our office. So even if we are aware of some sort of non-compliance that is out there in the industry, we cannot of our own accord go and initiate an investigation. We have to deal with complaints that are lodged with our office. And similar to a court, we will make orders to remedy any non-compliance. But our jurisdiction is limited in that regard, and that's how we try to resolve some of the issues.
10,000 complaints is 10,000 complaints too many, and a lot of them are centered around whether or not employers are contributing or paying over the contributions of employees for the benefit of employees where it relates to pension funds. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the Deputy Pension Funds Adjudicator, Naeem Esop, for giving us a sense of the report they submitted to Parliament, some of the insights within or contained within that report, as well as what we can do to protect ourselves as pension fund contributors.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it's Digital Drive time on a Monday. We are taking a look at some latest developments in the tech space with our resident tech and EV specialist, Nafisa Akabor. This week, we are taking a look at a new law that came into effect just last week that could potentially affect how you fly, especially if you are flying through the Middle East and into Europe. Nafisa joins me on the line down to take a look at the latest ban, or so it's been called, on power banks. Nafisa, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much, as always, for taking the time. Why are we banning power banks? What's going on here?
Hey, Jimmy. Always good to be back. So I'm sure we know, just taking a few steps back, that batteries are not allowed into your checked bags. So now, well, we could only carry our batteries and lithium-ion batteries and gadgets with us due to some fires that occurred in Hong Kong, I think, and South Korea earlier this year in direct relation to a power bank. It's now become a fire risk. And so when you are flying with your power bank with you, you're not allowed to use it. So what this means is Emirates themselves, being the one of the largest airlines and, you know, one most easily accessible, they've now put their ban in place just a few days ago, where they say it's banned, which means you can absolutely carry the power bank with you, but it cannot be in the overhead bin. It has to be on your personal item under the seat in front of you, and you are not allowed to use it while you are in flight. This means you cannot connect your smartphone or tablet to it, and neither can you charge that power bank on their ports in flight. So that's the ban.
So you're allowed to travel with the power bank, you're not allowed to use it, and you're also not allowed to stow it in your hand luggage. It has to be stowed in the seat in front of you, effectively.
Well, basically, yes. If you have a backpack, that's where you should keep it. And if you don't have a backpack, maybe just put it in the pocket in front of you. But what's interesting, even though Emirates made such a big announcement about it and everyone is more aware, I flew Air France in August, and they also made an announcement. However, they didn't. It wasn't such a big deal, but I was very aware of it because I don't go anywhere without my power bank. And they made the announcement also on that flight that you are not allowed to use your power bank on the plane. So I thought that was the first time I heard of that.
It's very interesting that Emirates Airline has taken this approach. Now, Fisa, is this something that perhaps is based on some regulation or some legislation? I'm just trying to figure out if other airlines are going to follow suit, if we can expect this to happen locally. At the moment, it seems it's isolated to international flights.
Yes, so because this happened in Asia, a lot of the Asian airlines have enforced this, like your South Korea, Hong Kong, those kind of countries and regions that have put this in place. Now, obviously, Emirates being the biggest one, I wouldn't be surprised if we see a rule being more universal, because at the moment, the limit on a power bank anyway is 100 watt hours, which is 27,000 milliamp hours. This has always been a TSA ruling, so they're making sure that you also don't go above that. I think rather be safe than sorry and know these rules before you fly, and you don't want to be not able to charge your devices in flight. So my workaround for this as well is to just carry your own USB-A cable or USB-C. Obviously, the flights are not so new in the sense that they have USB-C ports. So it might be a bit of a schlep for some of us who use the latest Androids and iPhones where it's only USB-C. I do recommend actually considering buying a USB-A cable and keeping it with you for this very reason.
Nafisa, you touched on converting power bank sizes, and I ask of this because I typically travel with more than one power bank. Am I now going to be restricted from that perspective? Am I only going to be allowed to travel with one, or are we going to be looking at each power bank individually to see whether they are or whether they meet the requirements or not?
So that's an interesting one. Just like you, I actually also carry more than one. But Emirates' rule specifically was that you only can carry one power bank under 100 watt hours, which likely means I can't carry a small one and a medium one. So it is limited here to, look, 100 watt hour power bank is very big, 27,000 milliamp. The standard size I'm sure that you may have, that I have, is 10,000 milliamp, which is 37 watt hours. It's a bit of a gray area. I'm not sure. I don't feel comfortable carrying more than one power bank on an Emirates flight now. I would just carry the one.
Nafisa, clearly Emirates isn't the only one that's going to be enforcing something like this, but sticking with them for a moment, I mean, their airports have got some of the most advanced technologies in their airports. I remember going through the airport in the UAE, and they've got those automatic scanning facilities that automatically validate you, so you don't have to go through the person-to-person validation when you step into the country. Are we seeing that there were any new pieces of technology introduced alongside this regulation around the power banks?
So I actually flew, went through the airport last month, and for the first time in my entire life, I was told that I didn't need to remove my laptop from my backpack. This was at Dubai airport. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of new. I think they have the next generation scanners where you don't have to remove your laptop. And I've heard London Heathrow also has other scanners where you don't have to remove your liquids in a clear container anymore. So those are some of the advancements we're seeing. And obviously, it's going to take a while, but I cannot wait for those liquid bands to fall away and, of course, not removing your laptop from your bag anymore.
That's a big one. Not removing your laptop is probably one of the biggest things that could happen in an airport, especially considering that's what takes up a lot of the time when we are going through airports, especially when we're going through airports if we're connecting flights. Nafisa, do we think that the laptop technology or the technology being used from a laptop perspective is going to then later be used for identifying things like power banks? Because at the end of the day, those two more than likely are lithium-ion batteries similar to how laptops are.
That is a good point. I can't be sure about that because I had a hair tool that I was made to remove. It's wireless and it had a battery and it stumped them. I think it depends on the shape. You can easily tell on a scanner what's a laptop versus maybe a hair tool. So unless these scanners have better AI to pick up what specifically it is, then I'm not sure whether we'll be able to get away with that.
Lots of changes happening in the world of travel, but in the world of tech, more especially if you are traveling with a power bank, folks, be very careful about that. You're not allowed to use that, at least on Emirates Airlines when you go forward. But on the upside, you don't have to take your laptop out of your bag at the security checkpoint. So positives and negatives, some wins and some losses. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you, as always, to Nafisa for joining us and for her time. That was Nafisa Akabor, the founder of Recharged.co.za. Also our resident tech and EV specialist, joining us to take a look at the latest regulations around power banks in some airlines.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the end of the show, folks. If you've missed the conversations, of course, you know they'll be made available as podcasts. It is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hurst is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.